Hey, what's up? This is D-Fuse back with you again. Thanks to everyone that's been listening to the show. Reconstruct, we're here with episode number 10, and I want to make sure you guys know, if you like the show, if you like what you're hearing, please tell people about it. Share the show on your pages and just tell your friends about it. We have no budget. So if you like the show and you want to keep it running, you know, we're just asking, just tell your friends. All right. So as I mentioned on the last episode on number 9, that I do have my new release coming out, my new mix release, and it is Psychotrance 2050. It's almost an hour and a half of music, and it will be a private link sent to everybody. That all you have to do is send me your email. So just go to the Reconstruct Podcast at Gmail. Once again, the Reconstruct Podcast at Gmail, and just say, hey, I want a copy of the new mix, and we'll get you a link for that. Okay, so we're going to go just straight into... We were just leaving off with Culture Industry, and let's see. I'm still just going to be going by my book, which I keep talking about the book, and it's a ways down the road, but I'm just going to use this as an outline of what I talk about on the show. And let's see. So how it started is that... that we got with Jeff, and we finished our first song, which would go on to be called Resolve in Silence. And we came up with the band name, which was Culture Industry. And we worked really hard at that point. It was me, Jerry, the guitarist, and Jeff Moeller, the engineer, keyboardist, studio owner. And we all got together. And so at first, I would go pick up Jerry. He didn't have a car. And I would go pick him up. And then we would drive to all the way to North Austin, all the way from San Marcos. And we would write. And he came to, I think, the first couple of sessions with us. And we did some songs together. And it was going pretty well. He was mostly just kind of putting in guitar parts and a few little ideas here and there. But mostly he wasn't really active in the band. I'm not sure if he was really happy about what we were doing at that time, but he basically started saying, well, I know you guys were supposed to go into the studio today, but I'm going to miss today. And it would be the next day would be the same. And I think we were doing two nights a week doing studio work, which was a lot for me because I was doing my DJ company, bartending, and going to school at least 12 hours at that time. So it was a lot to handle, especially adding the band in. But we worked hard, and in a way, Jeff and I really clicked. And so Jerry not being there, whether he was to say yes or no, or yes all the time or whatever, we didn't have to bounce ideas off of his head. And it streamlined the process. Once again, it would be something that I would learn in the future, as far as there's a lot of times you can have too many cooks in the kitchen, and you have to really look at it and understand that if you better have a lot of good ideas coming, or a lot of people that get along in a really good sense. Otherwise, ideas are going to get compromised and sub-compromised, and sometimes it just comes out safe rather than someone's edgy idea that they had in the first place. So that would be something I would carry with me to future studio stuff when I would become D-Fuse. So we just started writing. And before we knew it, we had a full live set of about 45 minutes. I guess about 10 songs, something like that. Our songs were about 4 minutes long. And we were pretty excited. So it was like, okay, cool. Let's get on the road. Let's go start playing some live shows. We're a live band. Let's do it. And at first it was really, really tricky because we really didn't know. We were a band that was, we would call it, we were based out of Austin, which basically most of us were. I was in San Marcos, but everyone else was in Austin. We wanted to be an Austin band. And we just had a hard time finding gigs. We found that in the live music scene, if you didn't have a following, it was hard to get a gig. And it was, if you couldn't get a gig to develop a following, and that whole back and forth thing that everyone deals with almost any industry out there. So we basically started playing at a couple of places. One was Steamboat on 6th Street. I don't think it's still there anymore. It was a legendary venue for a long time, decades in Austin. So I'm not sure if Steamboat still exists. It was a huge name back in the day. But anyway, we were so excited. We got a gig there. And we also got a gig at the Back Room, which was a live music venue in, Southeast Austin, something like that, along Ben White Boulevard, which is now 290, I guess. Dating myself once again. And the thing was, is you played, but they would give you tickets to the show. So they would print you out custom little tickets, little paper slips that said, Culture Industry Live, $1 cover with this ticket. And so the idea was that you give these to enough of your friends and enough of your coworkers or enough of anything, or put them at enough record stores or anything, that you'd have some people show up to your gig. That's what you really wanted. You knew $1 a person wasn't really going to pay the bills, and that's what you got at the end of the night. They would tally up the tickets, and then they would give you that amount on how many people walked in. And on any given night, on those first few shows we did at live venues with that method, I think we had maybe 20 people at a show, and only three of them would actually be people that we had brought in. We weren't working it that much in the San Marcos scene. It was really hard for me. I was going to college. I couldn't really make my way to Austin to kind of glad hand and kiss babies and talk to everybody in the live music scene and see, like, get people out. And so I would kind of just give the tickets out, but knew that none of my friends in San Marcos were going to drive all the way to Austin. And same with Jeff. He didn't have any friends that were going to come out on a Sunday night or a Monday night. They never booked at Good Nights. To go come see us play. And a lot of times we'd be playing at something like midnight. The first show that we did at the Back Room, I really screwed up because I went in and I got the tickets and I signed the contract. The guy goes, okay, do you understand? And I was like, yeah, like I'd been there before. But I didn't really read the fine print and didn't say anything. So the show date comes along. We're so excited. It's our first live show out at a proper live club. The Back Room was a proper live club. A lot of big bands. Who did I see there? Well, we'll talk about it. The Band Live. How about that? But they had a lot of rock bands in there and stuff like that. They had Public Enemy. They had Rage Against the Machine. I think the venue held a hot, maybe 1,000 people, maybe 2,000. And so we were so excited for our first night. And so we show up, our set time was at 11 o'clock, which is not necessarily bad, but we show up at around 9:30, 9 o'clock to, you know, figure out our equipment and get it all set up to go on stage. And the guys were pissed at the Back Room. They're like, did you not read the contract? Did you not read the contract, bro? And yeah, I didn't. And apparently, as you had to show up at like 6 o'clock that evening to do a full sound check with mics and have your vocals and everything plugged in, do a full sound check, then tear your equipment back down, put it in a designated area so that when the sound guy comes on, he knows what your sound levels are. He's got everything taped off to know exactly where you're supposed to go. And then you bring your equipment on stage and it's a loose, like a more tightly wound machine, if you will, more efficient. I didn't know that. And we had to beg the guy. He was like, dude, we got another fill-in band for you. You're not even playing, bro. How dare you not read the contract? And we kind of understood, but we begged him. And he said, okay, well, we'll let you on at 1:30 in the morning. So we just strutted through and got on stage and set up our stuff. Some of my drums didn't get set up because we were kind of like, well, whatever. And we played, and it was a learning lesson. There was no one in there. At that point, it was empty. It was literally just staff and the sound guy. And so that was a learning experience. So we kind of, at the beginning, banged our heads against the wall a bit. I even played a live music venue. I booked a show with, if you remember my previous episodes, with Cafe on the Square. And the owner had opened a live music venue just down the road a little bit. It was kind of a standing room only kind of place. I think the capacity would be about 150 people tops. But it was cool. It had a cool stage. It had a cool vibe. And I thought, okay, cool. Well, this is going to be awesome. Same idea. I didn't promote it like I had with the band before, like Still Life, and threw flyers everywhere and everything like that. And so the club was dead. And oddly enough, during soundcheck, we were sitting here in bands where we were kind of fighting over time slots because we were supposed to be the headlining band for the night. And as it turns out, they had booked another band from Austin. Oddly enough, that earlier band from Austin had Slade. His name was literally Slade Cutter. The bassist from my band Still Life that I told you guys about, that was, we were the biggest band in San Marcos for a long time. And Slade was playing bass for this band. And I remember seeing him, and we've worked out time slots. They got the better deal because no one was there. And so they played their show and I got to see him, and there were a few people there. When we played, it was pretty much like 10 people, 10 of our friends. And so it was kind of a learning lesson on don't get what you wish for, because we did not want a headline that night. And I kind of just thought about, okay, well, we all kind of talked about it. And I thought, okay, well, I'm approaching this entire thing absolutely wrong. I need to approach it with what I know. And what I knew at that time was that there were a lot of college type people that were coming to our shows as Still Life. Now, granted, we were a cover band, but we worked our asses off to get our name known. We plastered our name on flyers all the time. We went through, like I mentioned, through college campuses and just plastered them on any space that would allow some tape to stick to it, pretty much. And we did it that way. And I realized I wasn't doing that with culture industry. And it was time to rethink everything. And I kind of reverse engineered it. I said, I know we don't have a big following, but what if we start with releasing an album? And the guys were kind of, well, I don't know. That costs money. And when I say release an album, just to release a cassette, to release a cassette tape. And like, I don't know, that costs money. And I said, look, I work a lot of hours. I've got student grants that have come in from the government for my college. And I've been able to work it out. So I tell you what, I'll pay for the cassettes to be done. You guys pitch in a little bit if you want. I just ask that we sell them and then I get the proceeds to at least cover the cost for them before we start dividing everything out, like we were going to sell a bunch of records or something. And so we went to the studio and worked hard, and Jeff and I released, and Jerry threw down some really killer guitar. There were guitar licks that he did that I had other guitarists that came in to copy what he was doing once he left the band. But he was really good, but he wasn't putting in a whole lot. It was mainly Jeff and I at that point. And we really started working hard, and we released the cassette. It was Culture Industry. The album was called Welcome to the Industry. And my girlfriend Sheridan, who was a really great artist, did the cover. And she did this. It was like this abstract sort of black meets white image of this woman, kind of windblown woman. It was dramatic and cool, and it looked great. And we paid extra to get the fold out so you could see the lyrics and everything. And I was really excited. And here's probably what I was most excited about, is that it was shrink wrapped. I know that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it was shrink wrapped. You had to pay extra for the fold out and extra to get the shrink wrap. And it, so it looked pro. And we would take it to record stores and they sold a few copies and we'd give it to a few friends. I learned after that, that just give it away. It's your album. A friend of yours is going to listen to it. Maybe someone you know is going to listen to it. Maybe they'll be a fan or not, but at least they listen to it. If you hold back and just think, okay, well, I need to make some money on this. I'm selling it for $5 or $10 or whatever. It might not work out. You're not going to get as many listeners. And that's how it worked out. I wound up with so many. And oh, mention of that, if anyone out there happens to have a copy of Culture Industry, Welcome to the Industry on cassette tape, I would love to get a copy back because I've lost touch with Jeff and I can't find it anywhere on the internet or anything like that. And my mom doesn't have a copy. She's got a copy of Still Life on cassette, still in shrink wrap, but she does not have a copy of Culture Industry. So we released it. It sounded great. We were getting airplay at the radio station I was doing. They liked it a lot in San Marcos at the college. We were doing, Jeff actually learned how to get, he went to night school and figured out, he took a class in how to edit. And in taking that class at Austin Community College, he was able to learned how to, he was able to have access to the editing bay and he learned how to do videos. So our first video, which was called Push Me, we just did it out of nowhere. Jeff would mount a camera to a remote control car and drive it through carpet and drive it through random scenes. And then we would take, he would take it and put it in black and white. We'd add old scenes from old war footage from Vietnam or something random. And I remember when we shot the video, we're hanging out at this shopping center that was kind of, back then, God, in the mid-80s, everything was kind of going out of business in Austin and everywhere else in Texas. I think it was because of the SNL scandal loan thing. But either way, there were a lot of empty shopping centers. And so we went behind one. It was a big parking lot. We had the whole thing to ourselves. I had just a couple of drums, electronic drums set up on a stand. And I had a couple of drumsticks. And he had his keyboard set up. And it was truly 80s looking. It was the tail end of the 80s, so we might have been behind the curve. But it looked like, you know, someone like a Depeche Mode or something like that doing the video. And I'm jumping around, and he's jumping around. And it actually got really good play on Austin Access, if you remember Access Stations. They had a video show that was mostly just Texas music, mostly Austin music every Friday night. And it actually was the way they started their show for weeks and weeks. So all of these things started kind of eking out. And we were kind of trying to build our scene from the ground up in a different way than just playing shows and then having people come to more shows. We were really trying to create an audience. And I was excited because I didn't realize I had so many lyrics inside of me. So there's so many songs that I would come up with or that I had written down as poetry that I would translate into songs. I didn't have the confidence before Culture Industry to even try to do something like that. And when I say it was the lead singer, that's not fair. I was the lead screamer or talker. I didn't really do a ton of actual singing. In fact, throughout the entire band, I don't think I even hit one note because it wasn't required. If you're being ministry or being whatever, you don't have to really sing a note. You just scream. You act angry. And I was angry. There was a lot of stuff inside there at that time. But anyway, so everything was kind of rolling along. And I was learning how a reverse engineer with Still Life, we put a bunch of flyers up and then people came. This was a different idea. Getting the music out there and then having people come in from a different angle. And so I was learning two different angles. And all of a sudden, through all of this groundwork, through releasing a cassette, through releasing an album, if you will, all of a sudden things were going to start changing very dramatically for Culture Industry. And my life as the lead singer and drummer of a band. And we'll leave that for next week. Thank you guys so much for listening to Reconstruct. This is Defuse, and as always, thanks for listening.